Okay, we're good.
You don't even have to wear headsets or anything.
No, not nowadays, no. They said just make sure they're pointed towards the person that you're talking to.
Okay.
So we're here today with Ann Perrault. My name is Kimberly Shea. The date is December 12th, 2017. We're at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. And we're going to talk to Ann Perrault a little bit about her life history and for the oral history project. For the oral history class at Wayne State University. So if we could just kind of start in, I could probably just read the questions through to you and then we could maybe elaborate a little bit on it. Could you tell us a little bit about where you were born?
Sure. I was born in Inkster, Michigan, so 1959. And I was one of 12 children. And at that time, I was the fourth oldest. I was born into a family. My father was at the point of working on his graduate degree at Lawrence Tech University. And my mom, she came from the, it was kind of like upper Minnesota farm, and they moved here when she was probably about 15, 16, so. But they were both in the military. My mom was a performer and a singer. So that's kind of, we have a couple people in our family that are singers. So on your first round, so where you were born,
yes.
What were your parents? My mom's name was Joanne Hauger. Mm-hmm. My father was Robert Francis Perrault. His family grew up in Detroit. He went to Cass Tech. He lived like Finkel and Schoolcraft area.
The Brightmore neighborhood, or Old Redford, they called
it. Old Redford,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, he was, you know, in Detroit a lot. So my grandmother, she worked for the city of Detroit for a lot of years. She retired from the city of Detroit.
Oh, did she?
Actually, yeah. Yeah.
So your grandparents have a long history in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So how we ended up in Inkster, I don't know. It was probably after the riots. My parents kind of veered more towards that way, just like a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't really in the city. They were kind of living with after they came out of the military, they were living with my father's parents. For a while before they got married and stuff, and then when they got married, they purchased the house in Inkster. So, yeah.
So you mentioned you had 12 brothers and sisters. Is that
yeah.
There's 12 of you or 13?
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's 12 of us.
That's
total.
A full house, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's eight boys and four girls. So my father used to always tease me because I was the one girl in between six boys.
Were you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been a pretty rough and tumble existence.
Oh, yeah. You just had to learn how to kind of, you know.
So that must have, I've seen the houses in Inkster, and they're not huge. So
no.
That must have been, you guys must have been pretty close then, your family, growing up.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely were. We had a swimming pool in the backyard. We were kind of like a corner. So once my father got through, once we got through like the first seven kids or so going on the eighth, he started working, doing design stuff for the car industry, and then started his own company. And then, you know, so we were able to go from having no money at all to having some money. And he put in a pool in the backyard, and, you know, we'd have all the neighbors at our house. But yeah, we pretty much... There was three bedrooms there for a while,
mm-hmm.
and at one point we had 10 kids, and they built one bedroom downstairs. But it was kind of a little bit funky because my dad was an alcoholic. So, you know, that was a little bit the funky part until my mom kind of smashed him upside the head with a frying pan. And she was like, okay, that's enough. Either get out or, you know, straighten up kind of thing.
And that worked?
Yeah.
It worked for him?
Yeah, that worked for him. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. She didn't literally hit him upside down with a frying pan. But you know, she definitely kind of put the screws to the edge and said, "Hey, straighten up." And she was a tough lady. She is a tough lady.
So, could you share a little bit about, you mentioned that, like, your dad owned a design firm and your mother was from upstate Minnesota. So could you share a little bit about your ethnic heritage and, you know, if that was important to you as
real
a family?
Important to me. I mean, I'm French and German. My mother's maiden name is Hauger. And so she's, you know, full German, came over from Germany. It's kind of half her family is never to be said Jewish because, you know, they all converted at that time because of what was happening in Germany. So, anyway, where was I going with that?
So did your mother immigrate or your grandparents?
My grandparents.
In
my
the
grandparents.
20s and 30s?
Yep. So my grandfather's family were Germans. My grandmother's families were German Jews. But, you know, no one ever talked about that. You know, that was kind of erased when they came to this country and they were able to get to this country. So there was always that kind of back and forth. And so, needless to say, I dated a lot of Jewish women in my early runs, you know.
So you're kind of exploring the culture through that.
I don't know, you know, it just happens.
By association.
You know, it just happens. Yeah. You know, it happens that way. Life happens that way when you go back and look at it. So my mom's family was, so where we were going with that, you said to for me to explain to you.
Yeah, I was just a little bit curious about your ethnic background and how that influenced
background.
You as far as food and culture and so
right,
on.
Exactly. So that's where I was going with it, actually, because the German heritage. My grandmother was a baker. She did bread, my grandma, and she had 9 kids. So
she had to do bread.
Exactly. She had to do bread and she, you know, she could do anything. But, on my father's side, they were more city people. So they didn't have but my mother's side was definitely the kind of push towards food. And she had a pie business when we were kids. And I used to help her with the pie business.
Your mother?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so do you think that's kind of between your grandmother and your mother? You spent a lot of time with them, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I actually spent a lot of time with my dad's mom. I was really close to my dad's mom. But she was more on the other ends. She was more like the kind of psychic, kind of off spiritual kind of person that, you know, is in my other side of me that people don't know a lot about, which I do now, is I'm a massage therapist and a healer, you know. And that was part of my life before I really got way into the baking field and stuff. And so
that is something you're coming back to. It's like a full circle thing.
It's like a full circle for me. Yeah.
And you think both of those things, the food culture and the spiritual culture, you think you both get from different
parts of my family.
Of your family, different grandmothers influence those.
Mm-hmm.
You think?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So you did, in fact, some way influence all your kind of your upbringing and like.
Absolutely,
you know,
my mother
what you view
especially
like.
Because she not only you know the whole music part of my life. I mean, she sang to me always, and you know we just loved music in our home. So and we weren't of the class to like take lessons and do that, but it's like I played guitar all the way, you know, because I could just hear it and play. My brother sang for Michigan Opera Theater. So we were just musically inclined through my mom's side. Definitely.
You mentioned she was did that in the military, and then you guys had a very musical family. You said several of your siblings, right?
Right, several of our siblings. And we get together for holidays. We still sing and all that kind of stuff, all that kind of good stuff. So kind of like the, you know, the food, the music, the cultural kind of existence in my life was very strong, you know. Mm-hmm. They watched a lot of TV, I guess, but, you know, in terms of us, we were, like, always listening to music, always singing, always looking for this, always looking for art, always, you know. So, yeah, it influenced my life a lot, definitely.
That's interesting. So, did you grow up your entire, like, school career, primary school and high school in Inkster?
No, we left Inkster when I was 12 and moved to Groseal, which is... If you know where that is, it's an island in the middle of the Detroit River.
That's a big switch.
Yeah, it's a huge switch. Right. It was like night and day for me. And And, you know, culturally, it was really kind of tough for me, actually, because people were much more sophisticated, and they used to call me old-fashioned and stuff like that. It was pretty funny, actually. But, you know, you get used to it after a while, and there's the culture on Groseal is a kind of strange, but it's great in terms of boat and water,
yeah,
and farming. You know, you got enough land. We had a 2.5-acre garden. I had a horse that I delivered my newspapers on, and you know, we were out in the boat all the time. I still have a boat now, you know, so.
You have a sailboat, isn't that correct?
I have a sailboat, and also I've had a boat with a friend for probably 20 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it's a lot of upkeep.
Yeah.
Boats are expensive and time consuming.
I don't know.
So you really got to love it to do it.
Yeah. No, they're fun too. Though.
So you never mentioned, you said you were in between six boys, but you never mentioned kind of how you fell in the hierarchy of, you know, like the 12 kids in your family.
In terms of?
Like what, you know, what number were you essentially?
I was number four.
You were number, oh, okay, so there were three boys. So you were the third oldest. So you were the oldest girl.
And the oldest girl and fourth oldest, yeah.
So did you have a lot of responsibilities for taking care of her?
Yeah, oh yeah, tons.
Right.
Absolutely tons. It would be like.
Because I just imagine the oldest girl, and you get stuck with all the work a lot,
mm-hmm,
a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. And being that my father was an engineer, you know, he would design systems for me. So he would put charts on the wall, and then he'd say, okay, you see that? Make that work.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the chart would be everybody has a chore. And, you know, the list is just there, and so all I had to do is convince everybody to do it or help them do everything.
Right.
You know, till everything got done.
That's
you
funny.
Know, so it was a good system.
So you learned management from a very early age.
It was a good system, actually. You know, it was pretty good. And then my mom actually worked it out, so I would get off school from the time I was in sixth grade, mm-hmm, on. At my last hour, I never spent in school. I always spent it at home, helping her get dinner together, and then I would go back to school for sports and stuff like that. So I'm sure not anybody I knew had to do that for their family.
No, I can't imagine, you know,
yeah,
that they would, but I'm sure your mother needed and appreciated the help.
Mm-hmm. And she had to start working because my father's business at that time was falling down, you know, towards high school. And so she started working in the plant, in the car factory, you know, on the line. And so then she was gone afternoons, and I was basically responsible for everybody.
There's a lot of responsibility in, you know, younger, junior high school, whatever.
Yeah, totally. That's
really tough.
Yeah.
So did you, I know Inkster's changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
From probably the time that you grew up.
It was a little rough.
It's a little rough now, too, I believe.
It's really rough.
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, it switched over. About 10 years ago, it was rougher. And now it's kind of evened out a bit, you know. I mean, it still needs a lot of work over there, I mean, in terms of their schools and their communities. But it's coming up better.
What about Groseal? How has that changed over the time?
Well, you know, when the biggest thing, you know, that I saw in Groseal is the racial injustice when I was a kid. You know, I remember when the first black family moved down to Groseal, and people exploded their mailbox and put fire in their front yard. I couldn't believe it. I absolutely couldn't believe it. And I think it was one of the big eye-openers for me, but not... I mean, I had a sensitivity to people anyway, but there wasn't probably a black person that moved down to Groseal for another at least 6 or 7 years.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, because I imagine.
That's incredible.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
And what year was that? Do you remember vaguely?
Yeah,
just generally?
It's about 70, maybe 71.
So it was right when the housing laws were changing then,
mm-hmm,
as well. Well, it kind of leads me into the next question because I mean, being responsible for so many younger siblings, I'm sure it made you somewhat empathic for them, right?
Right.
And, you know, which only enhanced probably what you already naturally had.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wanted to see if I was going to ask you if you had an experience when you were growing up that led you to believe, you know, that things were unequal or,
mm-hmm,
was kind of eye-opening. And that would probably, would you say that was probably the defining thing?
Yeah, I mean, that, and also I was raped when I was five. Mm-hmm. And I think the gender equality thing became real aware to me at a very early age. You know, being the first girl and in between six boys, and just kind of, you know, being in a world where it was their world. You know, it's their world. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're kind of like this, supposed to be this princess girl, but you're not a fucking princess girl, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, that whole reality became real clear to me right away that, you know, patriarchal society was at its height. And, you know, so I kind of, the whole thing around religion and all that, I was like, I don't want any part of this.
You didn't buy into it from a very early age?
No, I don't want any part of this. This is not me. This is not who I am. And, you know, when I was probably like in ninth grade or 10th grade, my mom kind of realized, oh my God, she's really different. You know, mm-hmm. she's gonna be a handful, and she is not like my little princess that I thought she was, for sure.
So
but probably earlier than that, she realized.
Mothers usually know.
Yeah.
Were you excluded from things? Like when you were younger, like were the boys able to do stuff and then you weren't allowed
to? Well, of course.
Because you were a girl.
You know, my dad was a Boy Scout leader. Mm-hmm. You know, so he was part of the Boy Scouts. You know, from the time I went to a Catholic school in Inkster, and they had separate playgrounds. So mm-hmm. I used to get beat at school every day by the principal because I knew nothing but boys. So I didn't know how to relate to a girl. You know, especially when it came to playing. You know, they're out there playing baseball and football and stuff, and they're just jumping rope. But I don't want to jump rope.
Right, you have no experience with their activities,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it was more like that kind of a, for sure. But my mom used to do the same thing to me because of the fact that, you know, when we moved to Groseal, I got really into single engines. And so I used to take them apart and put them back together and build like go-karts and mini bikes.
You mean you're talking about single piston engines?
Yeah.
Do you still do any of that?
No, I don't do it at all.
Oh, I was just going to ask you because I build flathead motors.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, for flathead Fords from, you know, pre-1953 motors. So
awesome.
I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know.
No, it is.
Yeah.
It's totally, I got away from it only because, you know, my mom was kind of this person who was like mighty to me, you know, and she one day said, you might think about wanting to buy a horse. Maybe. Because
it was a girl thing.
You know, and I bit that hook, line, and sinker, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway.
That's funny, because my dad often jokes I'm the best mechanic. I've got two brothers, but I'm the best mechanic he's ever had.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, well, yeah. Education has ruined me, apparently. Oh. So when did you first realize that you said your mother kind of knew in high school, but when did you first realize that you were LGBTQ?
Probably when I was still living in Inkster, I had these two friends that lived next door. They moved in when I was about five. In fact, I'm still really good friends with their older brother. He's living in the neighborhood now. And, you know, I thought to myself, do I like one of those? You know, mm-hmm. kind of like that kind of a thing. And so I started wondering about myself then, you know, am I really going to, do I like boys? Do I like girls? You know, that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, for myself. And then I didn't really start to act on that until about eighth grade. I met this girl that I was really attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that must have been difficult because that was probably, I don't want to age you, but I'm going to say probably in the late 70s, early 80s, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I graduated in 77.
Yeah.
So, probably around then.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And things weren't nearly as open then. So how would you identify yourself now? I'm not really big one for labels, personally, but.
Yeah, I'm not really great one for labels either.
Yeah.
And I've had kind of interesting life in terms of labels, especially since I'm, seemingly attracted to bisexual women, and so that's always been, you know, has left me. Well, I'm single now, and I still identify myself as lesbian for sure.
But a lot of the women you've dated have been kind of on the bi spectrum. You would say,
yeah, absolutely. Not, they definitely were on the bi spectrum. And you know, my longest relationship was 16 years, and then probably some of my shortest has been maybe 5. You know, so, and I haven't had that many. So
it was like a series of long-term relationships, then, pretty much.
Yeah, and I haven't really dated a lot, you know, in my life, really.
Which is even more awkward now than it ever was, I'm sure.
It is, totally. Right. Those apps are just incredible to me.
And the things that people say on them, it's like unbelievable.
And the young ones that want the older women, that's a crack up.
Yeah, like, you don't even know me, how could you say that to me?
Really,
yeah.
Definitely. But yeah, that's how I would. I still identify myself as lesbian. And you know, it's funny because I was in the Temple Bar the same night that Jay-Z was at Little Caesars Arena, just a little while ago, just maybe a month ago. And a friend of mine, Stacey Hot Wax Hell, you know her?
I don't.
You gotta check her out. She's in her 60s and she does remix and house music. And
oh,
she
really?
Plays at different places. She plays it at the Royce a lot of times downtown. Mm. So, you know, she kind of attracts this older crowd that still love music, you know, and like to dance. And the younger crowd, too, because she mixes it up with some younger DJs and stuff. But anyway, I was in there and kind of being out at, you know, in this neighborhood, I'm kind of like, oh my God, Ann Perlman's on the dance floor, you know. But anyway, so people come up and they dance with me and stuff, you know, other people that knew me from the bakery. And so I went up to the bar because Stacy was up there just to say hi, and this woman comes up to me and she said, oh my God, I've had a crush on you since I was 19. This woman was probably 50.
Oh, really?
I was like, oh my God. And I met her years ago because I started the gay and lesbian coming out group at Affirmations.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's a pretty thriving organization now.
Yeah, it definitely is. I lived in Ferndale for a while, right when it opened. So I lived like right around the corner. I knew Jan Stevenson, who put a lot of work into starting it, and so we had lots of conversations and lots of stuff because I was working women's radio program at that point in time, doing women's gay and lesbian kind of network TV cable stuff in Ferndale, and also doing women's coffee house. So
you're really busy. So was
yeah.
What was your trajectory after high school, after you finished high school?
After I finished high school, I kind of, I ended up in this program. I played sports, so I got a scholarship for softball to play at Saginaw Valley, but I kind of ended up there in a really kind of weird way because my aunt lives in that neighborhood, and I actually was driving my car. My brother borrowed my car, and then I got arrested because he had drugs in my car. Get that, huh?
Great.
Nice.
That's
nice. Yeah.
Thanks.
So,
thanks, bro.
And I was looking at 20 years in DeHoco, you know, and it was like I didn't quite know what to do. And of course, my parents were just not doing anything. So I had somebody plea bargain for me. Anyway, I ended up being able to keep my scholarship and go to school up there. My aunt pitched in for me, and then she helped me out. She's a psychologist, and she, you know, they had me do all this community service work and say that I would take therapy and drug testing and all this for a really long time. Here, you know, I was pretty clean at that time. But I went through all that, you know, to be able to do it. So anyway, after high school, so I ended up there in Saginaw, and going to school at Saginaw Valley, trying to afford what little money they gave you back then. It was very little, extremely little. And and I was working for my aunt, and I was working another job, and trying to keep, at some point I just couldn't make all the ends meet, you know. So I played one season there, and then I came down to U of D. I went to school at U of D, and then I threw out my knee. And so then I got a job in a school for handicapped kids. And so and that was right when I was about 19, almost 20, because I graduated when I was 17. So then I started working in that school and going to Wayne State. And I started back with Wayne County for a little while, went to Wayne State for a little while, and I was going to, you know, become a recreational therapist or some kind of work with sports and therapy kind of was my edge to go forward. And then being in this area, I was in Detroit, so I had moved up from Saginaw. I had moved out, came back from Saginaw. I was at my parents' house for a hot second, and then came back here to Detroit. And it's really, when I hit Detroit, it was kind of like, I used to deliver the Detroit news when I was like 13 on my horse. So when I went to look for a place, and I was like, I remember writing all this stuff on my journals and stuff about moving to the city I used to deliver the paper to and all this, because I was in the newspaper when I was 13, because I was like an anomaly, because there was this girl, I used to never comb my hair, and it was just, you know, really thick and kind of gnarly and stuff, and I rode bareback all the time. Anyway, so when I moved into my first place, didn't that guy that I moved into his house have the picture of me when I was 13 on his refrigerator?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it was a picture, was it because you were delivering the news on horseback?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, but it was kind of like, nee, 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 and then, you know, it was kind of very strange, like I'm supposed to be here kind of thing, you know.
This definitely sounds like a sign of some sort.
Yeah.
Right.
So I started working with, I was starting to reach out, I was starting to date a woman actually from Saginaw that ended up moving down here, and she was working in restaurants, and I started to grow sprouts for a restaurant, and this group of women created this restaurant at that time called Casablanca, and they're both basically women from the Rape Crisis Network, and they started that whole calling system and survival lines and stuff for women. Way back, you know, in the early 80s, so.
Yeah, like the phone trees, because you didn't have the internet,
right,
or really any
exactly
other way to reach out to people.
Right.
Almost anonymously, because
yeah,
it was such a undercover type of thing in those days, you know.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of shame.
Yep. And so we were doing that kind of stuff, and I was growing sprouts and becoming friends with these folks that were really tied in, older than me. You know, they're now in their 75, 80 years old, but and that's where a lot of my friends were, you know. So I kind of, when I moved in Detroit, I got into that network of people, and there wasn't a community center, there wasn't a way, you know, for people to kind of meet people or be around people. So that's, and so, you know, I went to church things sometimes, and but I met this group of people through the restaurant that I ended up creating a, I started off with a production company. We brought in like different women's music things into Detroit, like Margie Adams and, you know, Fury and all these different music acts and into the city. And so that's how I started. And I went from there to doing the Detroit Women's Coffee House. And I was working in the schools and, you know, trying to still go to school and all that. And the school work was good for me because it's a limited day. You know, you're only working 8:30 to maybe 2:30, and mostly worked with severely handicapped. And so then you got a lot of time to be able to, you know, work on other stuff.
Yeah, you have your whole afternoon, and then, you know, all the musicians are notoriously nighttime people.
Right. Exactly. Totally.
So they're not even getting moving by the time you're done with a whole full day of work. So it sounds like, you know, we refer to that kind of like, because we have this, I have a lot of the same things in it. Some of the populations I work with, like at the museum, where they kind of create this, we refer to it as an informal social support group.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have people you can lean on or call for advice or do things where you maybe wouldn't have like a formal place to do that, but you know, you have a group of people that kind of hang together.
Yep.
You know, and there's nothing written and there's no agreement or nothing, but you just kind of look out for each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so that's kind of the group you fell into. You said they were older than you at the time.
At the time. There was only one woman that was right around. She's about a year older than me, and that was Lizette Chevalier. She was a musician, and she was the one that I started Detroit Women's Coffee House with.
So you two started that. So do you keep in touch with any of that group anymore? Is that group's, you know, are those people still in the area?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we're all connected Facebook-wise. I mean, Lizette has two adopted children. She's a professor at Carbondale University, and she's a engineer. And she's adopted three kids, two from China, one from Haiti. We kind of barely in contact, but not, you know, real close. Some people have passed, you know, we kind of keep an eye on one another as a group of people.
Yeah.
The person I probably keep the closest to is the political Shay Howell, who there was a whole side of my life that, because of one of my first lover was part of the National Organization of American Revolution, which was connected through Jimmy and Grace Boggs in the city of Detroit, which are well-known kind of political, analytical thinkers. And the other person that was connected to that was Shay Howell, who she's a professor at Oakland University, and she's probably one of the keener political minds in the city. If you don't know her, you should reach out to her. She's an interesting gal. She helped a lot, just a ton with Detroit Women's Coffee House too, and so Shay and I have a boat together, and we've had one for 20 years, and so we keep very connected through that. She continues to work with Detroit Summer and Freedom School and a number of different projects, Grace Boggs School, and which I don't do any of that anymore.
You're not active in any of those groups anymore?
I am not, no.
Is there a reason for that, or?
Well, with the bakery, I think that.
Did it just kind of get your life just get overtaken?
My life got really overtaken, between kids and the bakery, and especially with the bakery, and then the fallout of the bakery, you know, just. So the biggest thing I work on now is incinerator stuff and water stuff. I stay connected to, but that's about all.
So I was specifically asked to ask you a little bit about the LGBT civil rights movement in Detroit, because you know, like in the very early days, I understand you were kind of involved with some of that. Can you tell us a little bit about your involvement with that? And
sure. I mean, because of the fact that one of the bigger ways I was involved in it is the forming of Affirmations, which was a huge thing for it to happen for lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer people, you know, anywhere. We were, because of the coffee house was a hub for women, that was primarily supported by the lesbian community. So there was a whole group of people, not always the people that helped do the show and be there to make it happen, but kind of that surrounded it, that we did stuff, you know, calendars for Nipple Works. I mean, we did this whole defense for Karen Norman, which was this woman that was accused of first degree murder after, you know, self-defense, and because she kind of went crazy and, I guess, stabbed the guy a lot of times. But she still was attacked, you know. Somebody broke into her house and attacked her, and she ended up defending herself and then getting charged with murder. So we went on a big, huge, at that time, and we did a lot of Take Back the Night marches. We were so primarily focused on women in the movement, which was which always gave me that name of being a man hater, I think, early in the movement, and especially as we first started doing the boards for affirmations and stuff, people weren't so sure they wanted me on a board because I might not be so inclusive. But that's totally not the way that it was at all, and it ended up working out fine. But the, you know, beginning people like Henry Messer and those kind of folks that had that hard line of, it was tough, you know, it was tough in those days because people were raw in some ways in terms of not being really slick about or having any couth about how to talk. Mm-hmm. You know,
or how to engage in politics, you know,
exactly.
And effectively, right.
I'm
going to ask you my own personal question because this is something I've seen. I feel like I've seen. I feel like there's a lot of, you know, how you were speaking earlier about, like, you know, you noticed right away as a very young kid that there was, you know, this gender bias, right, between your brothers were in you, mm-hmm. and like in the world. Did you notice that in the LGBT community too?
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, and it was always this, you know, well, women really, if you were a strong woman, mm-hmm. and you didn't kind of like placate, mm-hmm. then you were always like, they didn't quite know how to deal with you, you know. And especially at first, I think now it's much more fluid, but because of the fact that the men really ran the movement, and you remember AIDS was...
Yeah.
Full blown at that time, so they were dealing with a ton of stuff at that time, too. And but you know, the women's movement was at a different point, and then it fell off into nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, really. I mean, if you look at the history of the women's movement, it kind of came to a certain point, and then when lesbian women really became really involved, it kind of petered.
Mm-hmm. And you think it's partially due to that factor, right?
Yeah.
That strong women are just generally, like, kind of discriminated against out of that culture of, like, being on boards and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. At that time especially, you know. And, I mean, I can still say to this day, I mean, I even felt that with Hillary in a lot of ways. You know, I felt that, the real left.
Bernie Sanders.
I really felt that in some ways Bernie Sanders undermined the gender of her and the way in the running of the political race. For me, it was just an extension of the distraction. You know, even though Hillary had her issues, yeah, definitely. You know, she had not only issues, she had a lot of strengths, mm-hmm. you know. But are we ever going to be at the point of actually having a woman in that seat? It's going to be an interesting, you know,
Well, we're coming up on the 100-year anniversary in 2020, you know, of the women's right to vote.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Well, it probably won't be by then, though, unfortunately.
Right. I don't know.
Which seems kind of crazy.
It does.
You know.
It definitely does.
Mm-hmm. So do you think because of your experiences, like growing up and coming up in Detroit, what do you think that the kids today, like the people that are coming up in the gay community, the lesbian community, what do you think their experiences are?
Well, I think that it's a whole different world because even, you know, I think a lot of people have gay experiences now. which before, you know, you would almost kill yourself before you would have a gay experience. Mm-hmm. And now it's much more fluid, you know, it's just a whole lot more fluid. And I in a lot of ways, I think that's good. And then in a lot of ways, you know, we're looking at, you know, I have a 17-year-old, and you're looking at so much stress for kids. You know, what is their, where is their focus? You know, where can they put their hearts? Where can they drive their passions, you know, in a way that makes sense to them? The only way that I see it is in helping other people, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that's not strong enough. You know, it's not a strong enough gate to actually draw them in some ways. I mean, I guess that's the way it was when we were trying to help other people back the way, you know, as we were growing up too. But there was a bigger sense of maybe unity in that, or maybe a movement in that, and where younger people don't have that now. Because I see a lot of kids being really lost, and drugs are a lot stronger now, and you know, so that's in terms of the gay and lesbian community, I think continue to be a place to talk about expansion and concreteness, you know, because there's so much, there's such a spectrum. And we have to be able to talk about that spectrum in a way that's in an open forum, I think. And also in a way that's grounded in and so that, you know, it doesn't become like on the other side of a sexual revolution, even though, you know, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. I think to provide the format to allow the conversation, and maybe it'll develop out of that. I think that there's still a lot of underlying work, you know, just basic human rights work that is not being followed through with, just basic stuff around marriage stuff, around family issues, around, you know, being able to bury your partner.
Hospitalization is a big thing.
Yeah,
or
I have those issues next with of my kin kids. Issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. So how
adoption.
Do you, like, yeah, that's always been a problem in that community. And do you feel like those gains that have been made are being, like, are currently under threat?
Oh, absolutely.
In some way, yeah.
They're totally under threat.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like you know, even in my family, it's almost like even though you're married and you have kids, or you're not married or divorced and have kids, you really don't have kids, you know?
It's not the same as if you were a man and a woman together
exactly.
with kids.
Yeah, you would.
It's not treated the same.
They'd have kids, you know, but, you know.
Even so, you have, like, all the same parental
yeah,
and
totally.
Financial responsibility for this
yeah.
littler person.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. But I think that now, with Trump, I mean, all that's attacked. You
yeah.
know, you take not only women's rights issues in terms of the right to carry or not carry, but all the way through to, yeah, who's to know what's going to happen? Hopefully nothing through the court system. He's not going to be able to change that. But, you know.
Apparently, they don't have to bake you a cake.
Yes.
If they don't want you.
No, well, hey.
that's what
you know,
we found.
We can also put a Christmas tree in the U.S. Embassy in Israel, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what we
so,
found out this week.
Oh, what that?
The court decision about the baker.
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
There's
I
a baker. There was a gay couple and their mother, two men and one of their mothers
mm-hmm.
came in to order a cake for their wedding,
mm-hmm.
and he said he doesn't make cakes for gay people,
uh-huh.
and because it's an artistic expression as a baker, that he is not obligated to do it. That was kind of the court decision. Because that is a question. How, you know, as a trained baker, how do you feel about current legislative efforts which would allow bakers, among other service providers, to deny service to people who disagree with their religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm. I think people have been doing that for a long time, you know, and they just have not been so openly talking about it. Shoot, there's a guy right here in the neighborhood that hasn't run into gay people, and everybody knows it, you know. And it's been for 30, 40 years that it's been that way. I mean, people have been jerks about their beliefs forever.
And using them to discriminate against others.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's not a new thing. It's a new thing that people are getting called out on.
Exactly. I think so.
You know.
Too.
Yeah. So.
But we always put everything. I mean, Cheney. We put that right out in the paper, right? And mm-hmm. and whether something gets done about it or not, that'll be a different. You know what are they going to do about somebody refusing so a service?
I mean. In my opinion, I mean, I think that you should have a legal right, but I think in the other hand, if somebody wasn't happy to provide a service for me, I don't think I'd want them doing
exactly.
it anyway.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So
and, you know, I mean, in some way, I feel the same way you do. I mean, I should have the right to say something to you.
Because,
you know?
Yeah, and it's...
Or put a suit against you or whatever for refusing me.
And at the same time, I don't want to use my economic resources to support somebody who is going to discriminate against me.
Right.
You know, in the next cycle or whatever, next
right.
voting cycle or whatever. So, mm-hmm. you know, why would I support their business?
Right.
And that's kind of my thinking on that.
Right.
You know.
I mean, there's in the world, I mean, we have to support our families that don't support us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my family didn't come to my wedding.
Yeah.
You know, my family is totally right-wing. And voted for Trump. I came home one day and the Headley, when Headley was running, came out verbally against gays and lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
I came home and Headley's banner was across the front of my parents' house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
So, you know, I mean, we have so many places in which we have to. You know,
right.
deal with
that. You're not going to deal with it.
Why in the hell would I deal with
pay somebody to deal with it, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Totally. Absolutely.
So, how could you just briefly? I know you have to go shortly.
Yeah.
I'm keeping an eye on the time.
Oh, thank you.
I was just wondering. Can you tell me a little bit about the neighborhood? Because I know the neighborhood has changed tremendously mm-hmm. since you've been in it. Do you think that all those changes are good, or? Some good, some bad. I mean, is there must be good points and bad points to all of it.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think, you know, thank goodness it changed,
mm-hmm.
you know, absolutely. You know, this was a really tough place 20 years ago, you know, all the mental health institutions, all the everything, you know, had closed. People were on the street and living in terrible situations. And we're not talking like five or six. We're talking, you know, you would probably run into 25, 30 people that I would see on a, hey, bread lady, you know,
mm-hmm.
on a regular basis that was, you know, living in the homeless kind of whatever shelter area that kicked them out at 7 o'clock in the morning. Or so, yeah, this area has changed a lot. I used to, I remember my daughter when she was three coming out of the back door right here on Warren and Second and saying to me, Mama, what are they doing? Because in the back seat of that car. But, you know, there's the prostitution was right there on the corner of Second and Warren,
mm-hmm.
you know, in that house, in that apartment building. So, I mean, the amount of growth and development, I think in a lot of ways it's been great. The high end of it is kind of hard to take sometimes, you know, because of it went really high end. In that, you know, split in between where it was and way up here, you know, some of us got lost in the midst. You know.
Yeah, a lot of people have commented to me that it's kind of inflated. The market's kind of inflated in Midtown right now.
Yeah, but it's not only the market, it's also, you know, the way that the retail came in,
mm-hmm.
the way that, you know, yeah, I even look at my business, the way that it grew and developed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a part of it anymore. So there's a whole section of the city that I think is ramping because, as you can see, that... you know, the city, when I've been here, it's 99% black, and it's not like that anymore.
Yeah,
you know,
not
it's not
this
that
part.
The services, you know, it's not that the neighborhoods are developing at the same point. So, you know, there's that ebb and flow of what's happening.
And the argument a lot of people make is it's not that those things aren't still happening with, the, you know, like a homeless population or prostitution or drugs.
Right, they're still happening.
It's still happening. They've just been pushed out of here with this gentrification process, right?
Absolutely.
You know, so it's just, they've just went somewhere else. Mm-hmm. They haven't eliminated them entirely.
Absolutely.
So do you want to hit anything else? Because I think we should probably get wrap up. I don't want to make you late.
No, I appreciate that, actually. No, I don't think I want to add so much else other than the fact that, you know, I do have children. And I think children are just an incredible part of a lesbian life and or a gay life and or both. And it's, you know, what I thought my life was in terms of being like in a relationship, having children, having a family, having, you know, it's way different. And I think that we are looking at redefining what family is, and that redefinition of what family is, I think lesbian and gay and bisexual people have a lot to say about all that, and we people really need to write about it, you know, in terms of just how that structure needs to change, and I think that's what I'd leave with.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for coming out today.
Hey, yeah.
Thanks a lot.
I'm a simple kind of guy, so...